Good afternoon. You're listening to Around the Block, a community news program from the Block by Block team at WPPM LP 106.5 FM. On this program, we explore issues in the Philadelphia region with voices from the community, with reports from our team of community journalists, and live in-studio interviews. We are also streaming live on PhillyCam YouTube and WPPM Facebook page. I'm K. Michelle Watson.
And I'm Mish Kasaris. In this episode, we'll feature stories about a symposium commemorating the 100th anniversary of a U.S. court case concerning the teaching of evolution in public schools, and how resistance to a Center City arena led a group of young people to create a space in Chinatown focused on arts and activism.
But first, Philadelphia health officials have identified the first case of measles in the city so far this year, and they want the public to know that you could have been exposed if you were at the South Philadelphia Health and Literacy Center at 1700 South Broad Street on Friday, March 7th or Saturday, March 8th, or the emergency department at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia on Monday, March 10th. Measles is a highly contagious virus that spreads easily among people who have not been vaccinated. If you think you may have been exposed, you may want to check to see if you received an MMR, mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine, or have already had measles in the past to determine whether you're already protected. Health officials say that this case of measles is unrelated to the outbreak that began earlier this year in West Texas and New Mexico. The patient in Philadelphia was exposed to measles while traveling abroad. But the case comes at a time when there's a national debate over the effectiveness, importance, and side effects of vaccines.
Yeah, absolutely, K. Michelle. I personally recently received a booster for my MMR vaccination in around, I believe, 2019, 2018, as there was a mumps outbreak at Temple University.
Wow.
But I know for a lot of people, that vaccination is given when they're quite young, so finding those records can be difficult.
Yeah, as we were talking earlier, I think as most people remember having a baby book. And I think now people with everything that's going on need to make sure that they keep track of their vaccination and records and, you know, reach back there and make sure you have things. There's an ongoing debate. Everything's going on. But the bottom line is take care of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Things are definitely a little bit strange right now with our current Secretary of Health saying in the past that they have been pretty anti-vaccination, but have been encouraging people to get their vaccinations specifically for what's been going on right now. So there's a lot of miscommunication, a lot of mixed information. So as you said, I think the most important thing is just making sure that you feel comfortable and safe.
Yes, I think so too. The University of Pennsylvania is hosting a two-day symposium this week on the legacy of the Scopes monkey trial, which took place 100 years ago. Reporter Marion Nickvert spoke with a Penn professor who is a historian of education to find out more about this landmark trial and why it still matters today.
The trial is important because it pit different views of science and religion against each other. It reminds us how divided Americans both were and are about fundamental questions like who should decide what gets taught in a school. If I disagree with the science that's being taught, what can or should I do? I'm Jonathan Zimmerman. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, and I teach and write about the history of schools and universities. The Scopes trial was a highly publicized event in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, about the question of teaching evolution. The state of Tennessee, like several other states, had banned it. And John T. Scopes, a school teacher there, challenged the law. It happened during the summer in Dayton, Tennessee, and hundreds of reporters came there. Even though it was in this small Tennessee town, it got telescoped all over the United States. Technically, the state won. The law was upheld. For the next several decades, evolution instruction in Tennessee and other parts of the South was highly restricted. But in the larger public trial, it's more complicated than that, because in the mass media, it's not a question of guilt or innocence or really winning or losing. It's about competing narratives. In some ways, the evolutionists won because they successfully cast the anti-evolutionists as these kind of rural backward groups. one of the reasons that we still keep talking about the Scopes trial is I think it created a kind of paradigm for culture wars.
And so what is going to happen in Kislik in the next couple of weeks?
The first evening, there's going to be a showing of the film Inherit the Wind. This is really important in terms of the memory of Scopes, because Inherit the Wind was a Hollywood hit made about 30 years after Scopes, during the McCarthy era. That film had an enormous impact on the way people remember the trial. So we'll begin with a screening of that film and then a discussion of it afterwards. And then the following day on Friday, there will be a series of panels of historians talking about the meaning of Scopes. And I think they'll be trying to make meaning of it and try to figure out why a century later, it still looms so largely in our imaginations.
The symposium takes place on March 20th and 21st at the Kislik Center on Penn's campus. The event is free to attend, but RSVPs are required. You can find out more at library.upenn.edu/events.
Ginger Arts Center is a youth-led arts organization and community center in Chinatown that was founded last year by leaders of student groups who had been organizing young people to protest the construction of a Sixers arena near Chinatown. Reporter Sultan Smalley spoke with two leaders of the organization to find out more. Ginger Arts co-founder Kaya Chow is also the co-founder of SPOC, or Students for the Preservation of Chinatown. And Ginger Arts general manager Mariah Gutierrez helped found SASA, Students Against Sixers Arena.
My name is Kaya Chow. The Ginger Arts Center is community youth and arts center located in Chinatown North. We have free monthly programming that's open primarily to high school youth, but we have people from all different age groups participate in our programming. Me, having grown up in the city, I personally have noticed a huge decrease in third spaces for youth and also just investment in youth in general. So this is a space where youth can just come and hang out. We have a library here. We have school supplies, art supplies, a bunch of different things that are free for youth to just use and come in. And I feel like this is one of the sort of spaces and investment in youth that is missing in Philadelphia.
What inspired the creation of Ginger Arts Center?
Me and Taryn Flaherty, the co-leader of SPOC, we wanted to mobilize college students against the 76ers arena. And we started to realize that, like, while it's important to fight things that you don't want in your community, it's like equally as important to think of ways that you can nourish and sustain your community. Just because we beat the arena doesn't mean that issues of disinvestment in youth, issues of gentrification, displacement don't exist.
Do you get the sense that this fight against the arena has made political topics, broadly speaking, more salient with youth? Or do you think that that's been more focused on Chinatown specifically?
I'm Maria Gutierrez. I think a lot of youth have gotten involved in anti-displacement fights in general now because don't happen in anyone's backyard. At least for SASA, also, that was one of our goals, that we unite youth from all over, not just kids from Central High School. We noticed a lot of the student activism in high school, at least, was from Central, and we wanted to like make sure there was a space where kids not from Central could come. And I think Ginger Arts really empowered us. We felt ownership over it, and like having youth from all over congregate and talk about the different struggles in their neighborhoods and their schools, and realize either we're all more alike than we thought, or some of us had more than we thought we did. Building community with different youth from around the city was really important to SASA.
Ginger Arts Center holds several events every month. This month includes everything from photography and painting workshops to dumpling making with a civic educational twist. And so I'm wondering, how do you guys see these events as an extension of your activism?
I found that like political education for high schoolers and like younger is not directly like teaching them theory, like giving them readings and like, you know, teaching them about politics in general. But I think it's just engaging them within their community. Every high schooler doesn't necessarily have to become an organizer, but I think it's really important to connect youth to their own community and empower them to feel confident enough to like speak up when something bad's happening. Spaces like Ginger Arts really allows youth to do that. because it makes them feel invested in. And I think it was really cool while we were building the space, watching youth be a part of like doing the renovations. They were there painting the walls, spackling, doing all the nitty-gritty work of just like getting this space open. I was able to watch the youth kind of feel ownership of the space. And I think that's something that doesn't really exist in not only just in Philadelphia, but in our current society. I think there are very, very few places where youth actually feel welcomed and invested in. And there are very few places that youth feel like they actually own. When youth feel invested in and involved in their community, then that's sort of like the necessary foundation to empower them.
The fight against the arena in Chinatown may be over, but the Sixers still own property in the area. And what happens to the community benefits agreement is still an open question. So given this, what does Ginger Arts see as its role in continuing this fight, if anything at all?
What the 76ers plan to do with that land is still really unclear. And so I think our role of just being the sort of support for like organizers will still continue because we have no idea what's going to happen. And we have no idea if like we're going to have to fight again. Also, we're thinking a lot about seeing if the 76ers can produce a actually good community benefits agreement that Chinatown can benefit from. I think that's the least that they can do considering the amount of like trauma and turmoil that they've put our community through. And I think that goes hand in hand with thinking long term about what development looks like. A lot of pro arena people and the Sixers were pushing the arena as like the thing that we needed to stimulate economic development, the thing that we needed to revitalize the area. But Chinatown has historically benefited not from corporate development, but from community-led development. So that's how we got things like Folk Arts Cultural Treasures Charter School, Asian Arts Initiative, the Chinese Christian Church. All of those things sit in the footprint of what would have been the baseball stadium in 2000. And those are all things that actually benefit the community and that were built by the community because the community saw a need for it.
What does Ginger Arts have planned for the future?
More ping pong tournaments and karaoke nights. Karaoke nights are really important for me as the resident Filipino, but staying open.
And how can people make sure that Ginger Arts stays open?
You can check out our website, gingerartscenter.org. We have a whole support us.
We're always looking for volunteers. We're completely volunteer run. So the more volunteers we have, the more evenly labor is distributed. Come to Ginger Arts. Come hang out. We're open Tuesday through Friday, 3 to 6, and then Saturday, Sunday, 10 to 6.
The Trump administration has enacted federal policies that target transgender and non-binary people. The president issued an executive order declaring the federal government only recognizes two sexes. Because of this, the gender expression of the people of Philadelphia and beyond is being targeted. In times such as these, it's important to rely on the support of our community. Jasper Leem is the executive director of the Attic Youth Center, an organization that serves young LGBTQ people in our community. They're here with us live in studio to talk about how these policies are impacting Philadelphians, especially our young people in the region, and what we can do to support them during this time. Jasper, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mish.
Tell me a little bit more about what the Attic Youth Center does.
Yeah, so we've been around for a little over 30 years now. I think we're entering year 32, and we started as a after-school group for folks who were LGB, really. We didn't have too many out trans youth back then in 1993. But that was also an era when we thought like LGB students and youth didn't exist, right? And I remember starting the GSA at my high school and they were like, oh, we don't have any gay students. And I was like, hello. And that's, you know, before I transitioned. So I'm a trans-identified person.
Yes, me as well.
So, you know, I think one of the things that's really amazing about the Attic is that we have these young folks who really are wanting to be on the pulse of what's going on. And, you know, I lost track of the question, but, you know, it's just an amazing group of young folks who get together, who get to meet each other and develop community. And I think that's where our strength as a movement is.
Awesome. And you said you also have like counseling centers. Talk a little bit more about the services that you guys provide.
Sure. Yeah. So we have a brick and mortar right in Center City, Philadelphia. And from 3 o'clock till 6 or 7, Monday through Friday, young folks can come in if they're between 14 through 23 years old and get to know each other. It's from 3 to 4. It's usually sort of just general drop in, get to know each other, sign in, register if you've never been there before. You get a little tour. A lot of our youth leadership council folks will give a tour for new youth who come in. And from 4 to 5, we run a series of groups. So that could be anything from drag group, Vogue, art therapy, gender euphoria is our group. And you know, a lot of different groups based on, some of them are run by therapists and some of them are run by our program specialists. And then we have counseling as well. So we have a drop-in counselor who is there for any youth who need it in the moment. But then we also have sort of traditional therapy. All of our services are completely at no cost to any of our youth.
It's amazing.
Including our therapy.
That's amazing. So obviously there's a lot going on with federal policies, the writing back of history, a lot of the removing of the Q and the T from various things, sports bans, schools. Tell me a little bit more about like, what specific things are impacting the youth that you serve.
Absolutely. Well, you know, right after the inauguration, when those first couple executive orders were signed, specifically targeting trans folks, I had a few youth who were like, am I illegal now? Am I allowed to exist? And that is a terrifying question for, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was in my like late teens, early 20s, you know, I had an existential crisis to begin with,
yeah.
Let alone to have a president of a huge country make this statement and make me question whether I have a right to exist. And so that was hard. And we did a lot of education. We had friends from ACLU come out and talk about what the difference is between an executive order and an actual law. But we see how so many other institutions are taking those orders and running with them, right? This was sort of gave a lot of places like the excuse to be as openly transphobic as possible.
Yes. So tell me a little bit more also, like, have you found like your services change at all since the new administration? Have you seen like an increase in participants? What has that looked like for you as far as your organization goes?
Yeah, I think that a lot of our youth are coming in more frequently. We have definitely had a tick in more youth coming in, new youth. But also we've had so many more requests through our online like webpage, just folks looking for therapy, support. How do I get involved? You know, and I just tell them, like, come by any Monday through Friday after 3 o'clock. Our schedule and all of our groups and everything are on our events calendar. We keep that up to date. So it's a good way to figure out, like, hey, what's a good day for me to come hang out?
That's amazing.
Hi. I have a question. All right. As an African-American woman, it's really important to me about the generational connection, especially with civil rights and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have anything at your center, which connects the young people with those that went before to give them a sense of their own history of what they've been through and what's happened.
Yeah, so I'm very proud to say that with maybe one or two exceptions, all of our staff, all 22 of us, are of the LGBT community, one way or another. And the two who might not identify as LGBT like, are super amazing advocates and allies. They put my parents to shame. And I hope my mom never hears this. But, you know, I think something that's really interesting about the LGBTQ movement is that we aren't sort of born into the movement the same way, you know, race and ethnicity-based cohorts are, okay. Right? So because generally, most of us are born to straight parents, and most of us don't come into our identity until a little bit later, right? We don't, you know, you don't pop out and say, congrats, you have a queer kid, right? That tends to show up a little bit later. So one of the things that's really important to us is to make sure that our young folks have connections to our history, because right now they're in their, you know, mid-teens, early 20s, and they're coming into their identities, they're finding community, but they don't know all that we've done before. So when we've talked about these new policies and how, you know, will I be able to get gender-affirming care? Will I still be able to have access to my hormones? Do I need to find a new provider? Do I need to get a new passport or ID or whatever? All of those questions, I remind them, I'm like, hey, I'm just going to step you back for a minute and remind you that. So I started my medical transition in like the late 2000s, like 2008-ish. And back then, no insurance covered anything, at least not in Pennsylvania, not gender related, and everything got paid out of pocket. You had to find one of like two providers who were in the area that did gender affirming care, right? And it, the insurance policies actually would have a clause that said that anything related to, you know, transgender or gender identity care was considered cosmetic. And it's because of all the research and things that have been done that we realized that we were able to make the case that no, this is not cosmetic. This is life-saving, life-preserving work, right? Because we know that the issue, when we talk about all the statistics around like trans folks and suicidality or mental health and all that stuff, the issue isn't that they're trans and that's why they're suicidal. Because we see trans folks in other countries that are affirming, and we see trans folks here who have affirming communities, their rates of suicidality are much lower. Right. So the issue isn't that they're trans. The issue is that they're not being accepted and affirmed. Okay. And so it's terrifying to have someone coming in from the outside who's not part of our community, who clearly has a lot of misinformation about what it means to be trans, make policies that are also, frankly, scientifically incorrect.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit more about, we spoke a little bit off the air about your impact in like schools. Can you talk a little bit more about the policies that exist within the school and everything going on with Josh Shapiro right now?
Yeah. So Philadelphia School District, you know, I think that being in Philadelphia as a trans and queer person, I hate to say it, but I'm a little more protected here in this area because the city has ordinances that protect us. You know, not that they couldn't be wiped away. And then the school district, we have what's called Policy 252. So our one of our programs is called the Bryson Institute, and it is our training arm. So that is trainers, and some of our youth go out. They do trainings to any group of people. That could be a congregation, a company, another organization, whatever it is, any group of people. And we help them learn how to be affirming to LGBTQ folks, especially youth. And in around like 2014, a bunch of our youth and the folks who were running the Bryson Institute at the time helped develop a policy with the folks at the school district here in Philly to develop a policy that would protect trans and gender nonconforming students. That policy 252 is still on the books. But like any policy, it's as effective as it is upheld. And so what we would really love to see right now, especially with everything going on, is to see the school district and frankly our city, our city council, our mayor, really reify that statement, that policy with a statement saying, hey, we stand by this and it's not going anywhere.
Gotcha. Yeah, awesome. Just to shift gears a little bit and talking a little bit more about Kay Michelle's question, can we talk a little bit about the intersectionality of the population served by the Attic Youth Center? Do you often find that individuals who come to you for services are potentially from other marginalized communities as well?
Absolutely. You know, we live LGBTQ lives all over the place, right? So at the Attic specifically, I'd say about 80-85% of our youth are Black and brown youth. Mm-hmm. At any given time, about a quarter of them are housing unstable. And we know that, you know, housing instability looks different for young folks than it does for adults over 30. So for them, it's usually doubling up, couch surfing. You know, they're not street homeless in the way that we tend to see with older adults. And so we do have case management to help support them, help them prevent eviction if they have a place, help them find a place. A lot of them are trying to find more affirming places to live, either because they live with family of origin that's not supportive, or they come out and get kicked out of their homes. And I'd say at least well over half of our youth are living sort of below what is considered the federal poverty line. Mm-hmm. So we provide dinner for our youth every Monday through Friday. Miss Ingrid makes an amazing meal. And if we're lucky, then a couple staff get to eat that too. So
that's amazing. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the attitudes present in, you know, you've spoken about some fear coming out of this, you know, individuals coming to you with specific concerns about care. Have you noticed any other changes in attitudes? Is there also, you know, are people revved up right now? Like what is the general attitude of the staff as well as the participants in the Attic right now?
I think that because we are of our own community, like there's a lot of fear and anxiety. It'd be ridiculous for me to say that's not there, right?
Yeah.
We're all sort of in this existential crisis. And also, I think one thing that's really helpful about working at a place like the Attic is that you know, our attitude generally is that we are standing 10 toes down. We are doubling up. So if there are programs that our youth, or especially our youth leadership council, says, hey, we need a group around this, or we need support around whatever, we will make it. We'll make it with them. And so we're really bringing our community together in ways that, you know, we did before, but it just feels so much more concrete now and necessary. We are doing a lot of partnering with other organizations. So let's say if a young person says, hey, I need gender-affirming care, or I'm worried that will I still be able to get my passport? We have community partners that we work with, and I've been talking to them a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Good thing we like each other. Because, you know, and it's constantly, hey, has anything changed? Are you still taking new clients? Are, you know, where can I refer somebody? Because things are changing so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything, you know, it's so hard to be super general about it, but it's still good to know, right? Like, you know, we are talking as two trans people, but there are people listening who do not identify as part of the community, but still want to support the community. What are some things that they can be doing at this point in time to better support not only trans and queer adults, but especially our youth during this time?
Yeah. If you have, especially if you have a trans or non-binary young person in your life, or an LGB person, like anywhere in your life, reach out to them. Just say, hey, I see you. I love you. You don't have to change for me. That is an amazing counter message to what we're hearing all the time right now. And sometimes, you know, good allyship goes a long way. And allyship is an action word. It's not just saying, hey, this is great. Like, uh-huh, yeah, I have friends who are gay. It is saying, what do you need? Hey, can I bring you dinner? If you have, like, especially if you have kids, right?
Yeah.
Or like, can I do your laundry? Do you need help getting to work? Because all of those things that were already stressful are heightened right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think that's great.
Fantastic. I'm going to add one more thing.
Yes, please do.
Go to your school board meetings, especially if you're, whether you're in Philadelphia or outside. So we know that there's two people who are suing the Shapiro administration out in Western Pennsylvania because they don't want to affirm trans and non-binary youth. You know, I forget what the PIAA, like the Pennsylvania School Athletic Association, has said, like, hey, you have to do athletic games and things based on sex assigned at birth. And Philadelphia was like, no, 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 we're doing it this way because this is how we've done it. And we know it's not an issue. You know, I think it's important to really look at the facts when we are getting all this misinformation out there, right? Even like the NCAA chair was like, yeah, they have like 510,000 students in athleticism, like across the country. How many of them are trans? Less than 10.
Yeah.
And so we really are being the scapegoat for a lot of hate and misinformation.
No, absolutely. And I think that's, again, why it's so important for people to put focus on allyship during this time. Give us the general plug. Tell us where we should be going to get more information on the Attic Youth Center and all of that good stuff.
Sure, yeah. So check us out at atticyouthcenter.org, attic at like the top floor of the house. Or if you're a young person between 14 through 23, stop by on Monday through Friday, 3 o'clock. Our schedule is on our website. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn.
Fantastic. And you have an open house coming up, yes?
We do. Yeah, come visit us on May 31st from 11 to 3. It's a Saturday. It's the day before Pride.
Great. Thank you so much, Jasper. We really appreciate you coming in and chatting with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for Jasper Leem for taking the time to speak with us today. And thanks to Brad Linder, who was our last minute board operator for this episode. He did great.
Brad Linder is radio news managing editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is radio operations manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's radio program manager. I'm Kay Michelle Watson.
And I'm Mish Kasarius. We'll be back next month with another episode featuring more stories and conversations from our team of Philadelphia area journalists. You can find more episodes of Block by Block on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.